Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Nick Miles at 14 hours GMT on Thursday, the 21st of March. These are our main stories. Fierce fighting continues in Gaza, and now Washington ramps up the search for a ceasefire. The European Union looks set to crack down on unpaid internships. And baseball's biggest star is robbed, allegedly, by his interpreter. Also in this podcast...
Do you believe the election was free and fair?
We created, I think, the most open and democratic elections in the bloody world.
Putin's people are in buoyant mood as the BBC goes inside the Kremlin. Washington is Israel's staunchest ally. For months, it's vetoed attempts at the UN to pass resolutions calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. But now it's submitted a draft resolution to the UN Security Council calling for an immediate ceasefire linked to the release of hostages. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is in Cairo for discussions with ministers from six Arab states and the Palestinian Authority.
I think that would send a strong signal. Of course, we stand with Israel in its right to defend itself, to make sure that October 7th never happens again. But at the same time, it's imperative that the civilians who are in harm's way, that we make them a priority, protecting the civilians, getting them humanitarian assistance.
Tom Bateman is our correspondent in Cairo, travelling with Mr. Blinken, and he gave me this assessment.
There's certainly been a gradual change of mood from Washington when it comes to the current Israeli coalition and its leader, Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, they're distinctly unhappy about several of the ways in which the war is being carried out, and particularly the lack of humanitarian aid getting into Gaza and the absolute crisis this has precipitated on the ground. And also, they want to stop a full-scale military assault by the Israelis into the city of Rafah. As for the United Nations Security Council resolution, the draft that the US has put forward has been circulated for a couple of weeks now. What's new is it's looking like it's being submitted for the vote. That vote could happen within the next days, possibly as early as tomorrow. But there is a nuance to anything that happens really at the UN when it involves the US. It's not the sort of primary policy forum that it wants to achieve its objectives. And this resolution does a couple of things. Firstly, it has prevented or displaced a much stronger resolution that was submitted by the Algerians that the Americans vetoed. Now, that simply called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, so to stop the war in Gaza. The Americans vetoed that. So they've put this in its place, and it calls for an immediate ceasefire, but it links that ceasefire to the release of hostages. So it is a conditional ceasefire. And the point is that exact arrangement is what is in the deal being negotiated indirectly between Israel and Hamas at the moment in Qatar. So really, the UN Security Council resolution they're putting forward calls for exactly what is on the table in the ceasefire discussions already. Now, there isn't an imminent breakthrough on that, but certainly the Qataris are saying they are optimistic that they will reach agreement on that eventually.
Tom Bateman. Now, what does the word intern say to you? Perhaps young, unpaid, general office, dog's body, perhaps, who works long hours and is desperate to get a foothold in an organisation. Well, the EU is planning to clamp down on this by introducing a proposal to stop unpaid internships offered by unscrupulous employers. The BBC's Hannah Mullane is following the story and gave me the latest.
So the EU Commission have proposed a new package to improve the rights of trainees by scrapping these unpaid internships. Alongside that, they're going to guarantee some new rules too on those internships, which means they'll also get social benefits like sick pay and be entitled to some leave. And there's estimated a 3.1 million trainees in Europe at the moment, and half of those are currently unpaid. So this plan and new proposal will mean fairer opportunities for young talent, and that European countries will be able to retain that talent too, and they'll be less likely to look abroad for work. So it all sounds very positive. Nicola Schmidt, the EU Commissioner for Jobs and Social Rights, certainly thinks so, saying that this move will stop young people being exploited. But there has been plenty of criticism of this new proposal too. The European Trade Union Confederation said the language in the proposal was blurry and more needed to be done to protect workers on internships. And a lot of that criticism is coming because the package only protects workers. And the definition of worker in this instance is someone that has completed their education, which means students who often take part in these internship positions are not protected. And these new rules will also mean that there'll be rigorous inspection systems to kind of crack down on these employers that are using young people in this way. And it hasn't been decided how that crackdown would happen yet.
Yeah, it's going to be very complicated, isn't it? Very difficult to monitor thousands and thousands of different companies, small and large, across the EU. There are always going to be people who are desperate enough to get experience and willing to work for nothing, aren't there?
You're right. It's hard to know how this is going to work. And there are always going to be people ready to take these opportunities. According to the Eurobarometer survey in 2023, almost 80% of young Europeans had done one of these traineeships. And almost 70% of them said they got a job after that training stint. So you can absolutely see why these opportunities are so popular. The hope is that this will level the playing field, and those more affluent people that could take these jobs and are willing to work for free and always had access to them, those opportunities will be open to everybody, and they'll know that they'll be fairly paid. It could be a while though before we see any of these changes coming in. The EU system for bringing in these proposals is complicated. Member states and MEPs will pick apart these rules before deciding on an agreement, so it's unlikely to be plain sailing.
Hannah Mullane. Haiti is in the throes of a desperate humanitarian crisis. The UN says many, many people there are suffering from serious hunger and malnutrition. Well, the head of UNICEF, Catherine Russell, has said the UN just can't get enough aid into the country. And that is largely because the gangs control most of the capital, including its main port. Our Central America and Caribbean correspondent, Will Grant, reports from the north of the country.
To describe some of the living conditions in Port-au-Prince as precarious is an understatement. But the group of around 100 displaced families taking refuge inside an abandoned cinema have it particularly tough. Among them is Sarah Mollin, a 20-year-old computer science student. She and her family had to flee their home because of gang violence. Now she lives in the temporary camp under tarpaulins with no sewerage system or running water. And on some days, she says, the family doesn't eat at all. I go to school with no food, spend the day hungry, and then go to bed still with nothing in my stomach, she says. Now she sees no other choice but to completely abandon her studies. While the daily struggle to find enough food is nothing new in Haiti, the difference now is the scale of the emergency in food insecurity. Potentially millions of people are at risk of falling into malnutrition and already don't know where or when their next meal is coming from. There are a handful of success stories. Jen Schenk is co-founder of Second Mile, an otherwise fully Haitian-run maternity NGO and malnutrition centre.
So we have 11 rooms, so we can take up to 22 families. So one caregiver and child that's severely malnourished.
As she showed me around, we met Jesseline Joseph, a six-month-old baby who was dangerously malnourished a few weeks ago. The organisation was able to hospitalise him, and now, thankfully, he's putting on weight. Mothers typically spend 4 weeks at the residential centre receiving care and support for their malnourished children. Their success rate is high. Just 1% of children who leave their programme are later readmitted for malnutrition or severe hunger.
Under the corrugated iron roof of an outside classroom, about a dozen women are sitting with their babies lying on blankets on the floor, receiving instruction in nutrition about how to prepare simple foods, how to deal with the signs of malnutrition, what to do if your baby has diarrhea, all sorts of important lessons which in the current crisis are applicable to millions of families in Haiti.
With aid still barely making it into Haiti, the organisation has stocked up on emergency supplies. But co-founder Jen Schenk says she fears the mistakes of the disaster response to the 2010 earthquake could be repeated in this crisis.
A lot of these larger NGOs fly in and fly out, and they're handed all of these supplies and all of these aid and suddenly all of these funds to now hire all these people. You're actually hiring from all of these local NGOs when you could just help, you know, pay their staff members and help, you know, and give them the aid to distribute. I think that's critical.
Climate change has meant crops often yield poor harvests or fail altogether. Few know that better than farmer Odile Leong, who has six children to feed. His maize and beans plants are struggling to survive without proper irrigation, he says, and there is a severe local water shortage which has been going on for months. As Haiti unravels, Odile must continue to try to scratch a living out of the land. Yet rather than a temporary crisis, which can be solved by aid alone, severe hunger is now becoming the norm for so many here, another tragic part of this country's dire new reality.
Will Grant. Russia's President Putin has gathered his celebrity supporters for a lavish event in Moscow. That's after winning his fifth term as president at the weekend. It was an election that Western leaders have called neither free nor fair. The BBC's Russia editor Steve Rosenberg got a rare invitation to the Kremlin.
They say location is everything if you want to impress.
President Российской Федерации Владимир Владимирович Путин.
So, Vladimir Putin invited his celebrity supporters to one of the swankiest parts of the Kremlin. Pop stars, actors, film directors and decorated servicemen applauded as the president entered St. Andrew's Hall with its giant chandeliers, gold-trimmed columns. Oh, and the coronation thrones of the Russian Tsars.
Нам только очень важно совместно с вами. Почему совместно? Потому
President Putin thanked the VIPs for their support during the election campaign and for helping him get re-elected with 87% of the vote, a vote that Western leaders have dismissed as a total sham. In it, Mr. Putin faced no serious challenger. We too were in St. Andrew's Hall, having received a rare invitation to the Kremlin Palace, a sign, perhaps, of Vladimir Putin's growing confidence. But how would his supporters here respond to criticisms of the election? I spoke first to film director Andrei Konchalovsky.
Do you believe the election was free and fair?
We created, I think, the most open and democratic elections in the bloody world.
In what way was it open and democratic?
Yeah, because everyone can vote openly and you can see how the result. Nothing else.
Then I asked Margarita Simonyan, editor-in-chief of state broadcaster RT, whether she thought this had been a democratic election.
Do you believe the election was free and fair?
Come on. You don't?
No, do you believe it was?
Don't you tell me you don't. You live in Russia. You see that everyone supports Putin.
Everyone?
5-6 years ago, I knew a lot of people who didn't. Now, me personally, I don't know anyone.
Was there a serious challenger in the election? A serious opponent?
Is there a need for a serious opponent? Why?
Why is there no need for a serious opponent?
Why do you always think that the way you live is better than the way we live? You know better.
Not at all.
Yes, you do.
Why do you think there's...
Even the question, even the way you ask questions, you do. Why don't you guys do the way we do it? Because we're not you, and we don't like you much, really.
Was I offended? No. Surprised? No. was I persuaded that Russia's election had indeed been a level playing field and a victory for democracy. Once again, no. But the Kremlin will pay no attention to Western criticism. It will portray Vladimir Putin as a leader loved and trusted by his people. And Mr. Putin will use his 87% landslide as a mandate for whatever action he decides to take next.
Steve Rosenberg. Now, the Japanese baseball player Shohei Ohtani is one of the biggest names in the sport. He's an all-rounder for the Los Angeles Dodgers, but his batting and pitching is, it's safe to say, more fluent than his English, so he often has to rely on his interpreter to get his message across to the American media. Now, though, his interpreter, Ippei Mitsuhara, has been sacked after being accused of stealing millions of dollars from him. Our correspondent, Sharma Khalil, is in Tokyo.
We understand that these allegations are of massive theft. That's how they've been described, and they're connected to illegal gambling. According to the U.S. sports network ESPN, $4.5 million were transferred from Shohei Ohtani's account to a bookmaker. ESPN also said that it reviewed bank information with Ohtani's name on $2.5 million payments to a bookmaking operation run by someone who'd been reportedly investigated for illegal sports betting. But even though Ohtani's name is on the paperwork, if you will, we know for a fact that he himself is not accused of any wrongdoing. We know that his interpreter, his long companion, Ippei Mitsuhara, has spoken to ESPN. The problem is that his account of what happened has been quite murky. In an interview, he told the network that he'd asked the baseball star to help him cover his gambling debts. And then he changed his story, saying that Shohei Ohtani didn't know about the issue, didn't know about his gambling debts, and did not transfer any money. So how he managed to make those transfers, how he managed to steal or allegedly steal this amount of money, that's still being researched at the moment and being investigated. One of the spokespeople of the team of the LA Dodgers has spoken to the BBC, and they said that they're gathering information, but confirmed that the interpreter had been sacked. But this is, of course, huge news, not just because of how big and popular baseball is. It is because this is a man that's very closely connected to Shohei Ohtani. And there just isn't a bigger name, not just in Japanese sport, but in Japanese pop culture in general, than Shohei Ohtani at the moment.
Sharma Khalil. Still to come in this podcast.
I do hope that visitors can come now and that they will have the interest in learning more about pygmy hippos and also seeing our little baby boy as well. I hope they are as excited as we are about this little one.
Why there's so much excitement around this newborn baby.
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being. I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're hearing from some incredible women about what their countries are getting right.
And picking the best bits for our female fantasy land. Because you can't build it if you can't imagine it first. Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
We've talked a lot recently about the new wave of space exploration. Unmanned landings on the moon, giant rocket launches that could take astronauts there and beyond. But here's something that will enable everyone to enjoy the wonders of Earth from space. A British company, SEN, is sending high-definition cameras up to the International Space Station that will live stream high-quality pictures of Earth back to Earth. that you can see on a laptop or a smartphone. Charles Black is the founder and boss of Sen, and he told Johnny Diamond what high-definition views people can expect to see.
One camera is a wide-angle panoramic view, which will look at a sort of 1,000-kilometre scene across the horizon, so you're really going to see the curvature of the Earth. And then the camera looking down is looking at a scene about 250 kilometres by 150 kilometres. So it's really focusing on the environment and geography. So you're seeing rivers and mountain ranges, and you will see cities as well.
A lot of these space missions must strike most people as fairly elite projects. You are, in some small way, trying to give them back to everyone.
Yes, that's right. Satellites traditionally have been used to capture imagery for governments and for scientists, and all that's really important. And what we want to do is capture imagery and make it accessible to everyone, because we want to, if we can, try and give people, everyone, similar views of the planet that astronauts get. And there's about 600 astronauts that have gone to space, and they all look down at Earth and say that it gives them this overview effect, this cognitive shift. It changes the way you think about the planet. You see the delicate thin blue atmosphere protecting us, and seeing the environmental events and how the planet is changing every day. And it's a living, breathing world. And there's 8 billion of us on it. And, you know, we want to look after it and see its beauty. And in the same way that Google gives everyone access to, if you like, every fact in human history, what we want to do is create a real-time data set about what's happening now, what's unfolding now. And the data, as well as providing beautiful imagery, it also serves an important purpose of helping people, whether that's emergency responders to environmental events, for example, monitoring climate change, and really using the storytelling power of video to tell a story about planetary change.
Charles Black there. Another row has broken out between Mexico and the United States over the issue of migration. Mexico has criticised a proposed new Texas immigration law allowing officials to detain and prosecute people they think have entered the US illegally. Well, thousands of migrants tried to cross into the US from Mexico every year. But with organised crime groups increasing their control of the routes, it's a treacherous journey. Linda Presley has been to the Mexican border city of Tijuana.
The messy city of Tijuana is located on Mexico's border with the United States, and it's built across a series of deep ravines. We're on the outskirts of the city, where the hills get high. Ahead of us, maybe 20 people. Sturdy shoes, spades, picks. This is one of Mexico's many groups of people made up of families of the disappeared. And they go out together looking for the bodies of their loved ones. Eddie Carrillo, who leads this group, has got his phone out taking pictures.
Eddie tells us that over 4 years they've found around 40 or 50 bodies here. Eddie's still looking for the remains of his teenage son, Eric, who disappeared 5 years ago after a night out in Tijuana. Over 100,000 Mexicans are registered as missing, victims of the drug war, impunity and the proliferation of armed criminal groups. Now migrants have fallen prey to the men with guns too. He says that often migrants attempt to cross the border here to the US without paying a coyote or guide. When they don't pay whoever has control of the area, that's when they may be detained. Eddie thinks that's what happened to a group whose remains he found nearby. There were 5 bodies, he says. 3 were together and another 2 separated from the group. 4 men and 1 woman, all shot in the head, execution style.
I call them narco coyotes because they not only cross people, they also cross drugs. So it's a new type of human smuggler.
Dr. Victor Clark Alfaro lives in Tijuana and is a professor at San Diego State University in the US, an expert on the cartels and the shifting pattern of migration across the Mexico-US border.
When I began studying migration at the end of the 80s, there were 30 countries coming to Tijuana, coming to the border. Nowadays, there are 120 different countries.
120 different nationalities.
Different nationalities are coming to Tijuana.
Tijuana's one of Mexico's most brutal cities. Murders an everyday event. And the shelters where migrants stay before they attempt to cross the border have become vulnerable to attacks too. There have been reports of armed men opening fire on one of them, residents being extorted at another, and one refuge receiving threats to burn down its facilities. Instituto Madre Asunta is a refuge for migrant women and children in Tijuana. Although painted a delicate blue, this is a fortified property with high fences, gates and grills. Jessica, from Honduras, is one of so many fleeing threats at home.
In my town, there's lots of drugs trafficking. Drugs, many things. My husband got involved with a married woman from a bad crowd. And when they found out about the affair, they said they were going to get revenge on me because I was his wife. I left that same day. I was afraid and I just left.
In the refuge, Jessica's feeling safe. She's waiting for an appointment with the US border authorities. She wants to enter the US legally so she doesn't have to pay a coyote or people smuggler. But make no mistake, migrants in Mexico have become fair game for organised crime.
Linda Presley. Working in extreme heat can double the risk of stillbirth and miscarriage for pregnant women. That's according to new research from India. The study found that the risks to mothers-to-be are significantly higher than previously thought. Researchers say hotter summers can affect not only women in tropical climates, but also in countries like the UK and other parts of Western Europe. It comes as the World Health Organization warns that pregnant women and babies face some of the gravest consequences of all as a result of climate change. Professor Jane Hurst of the George Institute for Global Health, one of the authors of the study, is in Chennai in India. She explained a bit more about what she found out to my colleague Davina Gupta.
Basically, what the research has shown is that there was a doubling of the risk of miscarriage and stillbirth and other adverse pregnancy outcomes, such as preterm birth and low birth weight, in those workers in India who were exposed to very high heat during their workplace during the pregnancy. This is concerning because whilst there's evidence emerging from other centres around the world of an increase in these risks with heat exposure, the level of risk seems to be much higher in this group in India. And that may be to do with other exposures that they have, you know, such as, you know, socioeconomic stat factors and air pollution and other things. But we really don't know yet. So we're currently trying to explore this in another large study, trying to answer some of those questions as to why this is happening to this group of women and really working out, you know, what can be done to prevent it.
But just to point out, the sample size that you've taken were of women who are from the poor strata of the society. Their socioeconomic levels are such that they have to do certain jobs which are in the heat with limited access to, as one person pointed out, even loos.
Exactly, yeah. So, of course, you know, there's a stark socioeconomic gradient of those people who have to work out in these extreme heat conditions versus people who can sit in an air-conditioned office. So controlling in our research for all those different factors, which are also risk factors for stillbirth in their own right, was an important part of this research.
And is there a temperature which poses the highest risk for these women?
That's a really good question, and we don't know the exact answer to that yet. The temperature that's risk, it depends a lot on also the air humidity and other atmospheric conditions, but also importantly on the amount of work the woman's doing and her body shape and things as well. So we're trying to develop some clearer guidelines for workplaces and for pregnant women. But certainly the advice would be to avoid.
But just in the interest of time, Professor Hurst, for a lot of them, there's no choice but to work out in the sun. So what kind of guidelines do you suggest?
Yeah, that is true. I think the guidelines would be around providing shade stations, you know, in outdoor work, making sure that the work is not done in the hottest part of the day, and providing women, as you say, with toilet facilities and water for rehydration. Because if there are no toilets, many women we found were dehydrating themselves, so they didn't need to go to the toilet. And this would probably be making any effects of the heat on their pregnancy even worse.
And could the research have an impact on safety advice for pregnant women globally?
Definitely. That's what we hope. I mean, as our planet continues to warm, more and more pregnant women will be exposed to extreme heat, but not just those who have no choice but to work in the heat, but women who are in high-income countries as well, and those who may go on holiday to warmer climes during their pregnancy.
Professor Jane Hurst. Pygmy hippos are normally found in the swamps and rainforests of Western Africa. An endangered species, there's thought to be only about 2,000 still living in the wild. You can, of course, see them in zoos, but a lack of males in captivity makes breeding efforts very complicated. So there's much excitement in Athens at the moment. For the first time in 10 years, a baby has been born at Attica Zoological Park. Elisa Hugenboom is the head keeper there.
He's a boy, yes. He's a little baby boy. A lot goes into taking care of the mom while she was pregnant. End of October, we, as keepers and me, we saw that she was slightly having a bigger belly. So that same week, we involved our vets to come and check up on her. And we were able to do an ultrasound, which confirmed our suspicions, which she was pregnant. They're very interesting animals. They're very, like the common hippos, which are 5 times as big as the pygmy hippos. They can be quite aggressive. They have a quite big set of teeth as well for that. It's a species that has trouble in surviving in the wild right now. With pygmy hippos especially, it's deforestation. So a lot of habitat loss because we're building as humans a lot of things all around. And they're losing their habitat, so the population just decreases because of that.
I do hope that visitors can come now and that they will have the interest in learning more about pygmy hippos and also seeing our little baby boy as well. I hope they are as excited as we are about this little one.
Alicia Hugenboom. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Darcy O'Brie and the producer was David Lewis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.